Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. For the best and brightest minds in this country, there's no more wonderful surprise than getting a phone call telling you that you are the latest member of an elite group, a MacArthur Fellow. The grants from the MacArthur Foundation come with no strings attached, and the really fun part is that the recipients have no idea they're even in line for the award until that phone call comes. In this episode, we're joined by newly minted MacArthur Fellow Kareem El-Badri. Kareem is an astrophysicist at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, and the objects he studies are some of the most interesting ones in the universe, binary star systems that produce hypervelocity stars and black holes. El-Badri grew up in a small town in Oregon, and his passion for learning led to an amazing career path, landing him at one of the truly great science universities in the world, Caltech. And he joins us now from the Pasadena campus. Kareem El-Badri, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'd like to start out learning a bit about your background. I saw that you grew up not far from where I live in Northern California, just up I-5. Tell us about where you grew up.
Yeah, I grew up near Roseburg, Oregon. It's a town kind of halfway between Eugene and Ashland. And I grew up first in a really small town near Umpqua, and then I went to high school in Roseburg, which is a town of maybe 20,000 people or so.
And when did you first develop your interest in science and astronomy specifically?
So I was interested in astronomy and space pretty much as long as I can remember. You know, when I was like 5 years old, somebody gave me a Guinness World Records book or Ripley's Believe It or Not or something like that, and I started learning about space. And when I was a kid, I used to tell people I wanted to be an astronaut. And that was my plan kind of most of growing up. But then at some point I learned if you want to be an astronaut in the United States, most of the time that means you have to go into the military, which I didn't want to do. So then I started college as a philosophy major, and I thought maybe I would do that or be a lawyer or something. But then I took an astronomy class that was just for non-science majors to try to satisfy one of my distribution requirements.
Yeah,
everyone has to take a science class. And it was really amazing. And that almost immediately kind of changed my plan of what I thought I might want to do. And then I took another class that was really great too. And then I started doing some astronomy research over the summer. And so I switched my major to physics and then to astronomy and went to grad school.
It's interesting because I know I've advised a lot of students over the years that are non-science major types that just, you know, have to satisfy that natural sciences requirement. I tell them, hey, take an intro to astronomy class. You'll love it. It's really fun and interesting. Or, you know, an intro to geology class. Those two, either one of those are going to be fun gateways to the world of science for you without killing you with too much math. Was your math background pretty strong going into this? Because if you're going to be a physics major and do what you do, you have to be good at math.
Yeah, it was pretty good for where I was at the time. You know, I took the best math classes that my high school had. So I had taken some calculus and then I took some more math classes in college. But astronomy is kind of, it's a smooth glide into physics. So you do need a strong background in math and physics eventually, but you can at least get excited about astrophysical concepts and pretty pictures and like qualitatively understand what a lot of astrophysical phenomena are without being able to do the math. And so you can pick up the math as you go.
Yeah, it kind of gives you a reason to want to study that math.
Right.
One of the things that I really like that I've seen in the last couple decades in college is that more undergrads get exposed to research opportunities. Could you just, you know, comment a little bit about how important you think that is?
Yeah. So now I'm on the committee to accept grad students at Caltech. And basically everybody that applies to grad school in astrophysics now, almost everybody has done research as an undergrad. So on the one hand, it's really cool because, you know, even before people have finished their education, they can already do cutting edge research and start contributing to open questions in the field. That's kind of what attracted me to astronomy, is that the barrier to entry is pretty low and the frontier of knowledge is pretty close. So you don't have to be an expert before you can already start chipping away at a real problem. But on the other hand, because people get into research so early, it makes it harder to decide to do astronomy later on, right? If you decide you want to do astronomy like in your last year of college or something, you're already at a comparative disadvantage to people who have been doing research since they started. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword.
Yeah. Well, tell us about how you got to Caltech, because when I think of, you know, the great astronomy institutions of higher learning in the world, Caltech has got to be right up there around number one. So tell us how you got there.
Yeah, Caltech is a pretty good place to do astronomy. So I was an undergrad at Yale, which also has a good astronomy program, but at least for undergraduates, it's more focused on humanities. And so Caltech has this big undergraduate research program in the summer. It's called SURF, or Summer Undergraduate Research Fellowship. And every year, there are a few hundred undergrads on campus that are doing research in the labs of Caltech faculty. And so in 2015, I came through that program and was working with a postdoc and a faculty member. That faculty member is still here and is one of my colleagues now. His name is Phil Hopkins. And I did a research project on galaxy formation simulations. And that ended up going really well. I wrote a paper about it in my senior year. And then I went to grad school at UC Berkeley, still kind of continuing on the same type of research that I had started in undergrad. But then about halfway through my grad school, there was the first data release from this mission called Gaia, which we'll probably talk about more later.
Certainly.
And that ended up being a big game changer for lots of problems in kind of stellar astrophysics, evolution of binary stars, black holes, things like that. And so I pretty strongly changed my research focus about halfway through grad school and started working on the data from this mission and doing more observational rather than theoretical work. Then I finished grad school. I applied to postdocs and to faculty jobs at the end of grad school. And I actually got the job at Caltech then, so basically before I finished my PhD. But I also got a job as a postdoc. Caltech decided to let me delay starting my faculty job for 2 years so that I could get some experience as a postdoc, you know, just doing research and becoming more independent. And so then I went to Harvard to do the postdoc there for a couple of years until 2023. And then I moved to Caltech now a little over 2 years ago.
Well, and recently, as we mentioned at the top, you were named a MacArthur Fellowship winner. And that's a really big deal. Aside from the recognition, you get a really nice cash grant. I think it's $800,000, no strings attached, which is lovely. And that's darn cool. And it's reserved for people with extraordinary creativity and intellectual promise. It's just an awesome award. Tell us about what it was like when you were notified and you found out you'd won that.
Thanks. Yeah, it was completely out of the blue. So it was about 7 a.m. one morning. I was getting ready for work in a hurry with my wife trying to put together our lunches. And I got a call from an unknown number, which usually I don't pick up. It didn't say scam likely, so I tried picking up. And somebody said, "This is so-and-so from the MacArthur Foundation." And right away I was like, "Oh, okay, there's probably somebody asking me for money." But I was like, okay.
Right.
and they said, "No, actually, we're trying to give you money." And then I said, "Okay, well, this must be some kind of a scam," because I did. I mean, I had heard of this program before a little bit, but I didn't know any of the details, and I didn't know that I was being considered for this. I hadn't applied, and nobody told me that I was on a short list or something like that.
Yeah, that's the way it always is. Is the people that win it, you know, it's not like they campaigned for it or anything like that, and it's always kind of a surprise out of the blue. So that your story is pretty typical and wonderful.
Yeah. And so then part of this phone call, they read me this bio that they wrote that eventually goes on their website, mostly to confirm that all the information they had was accurate. But that was detailed enough and had enough information about the kind of things I work on that I thought, okay, probably this is not a scam. Or if it is a scam, they tried real hard.
You're still suspicious, Kareem.
Yeah, yeah. I really only fully believed it once they actually publicly announced it, because it seemed very surreal.
Oh, I bet. Oh, that's just great. And after, you know, you realized, you know, I've won this, I bet it was really fun to, like, you know, tell some of your old teachers and people like that.
Yeah, it was eventually. So they told me maybe a little over a month before the
got to keep it a secret.
Yeah, and they told me you're not allowed to tell anyone except one person. And the one person I told was my wife because she was there when they called.
I would hope that would be the one person,
And then
yes.
she immediately went and told some of her friends, which she
Oh
wanted
no.
to do.
Oh no.
But they, for the most part, we kept it under wraps. But then the official announcement was about a week ago, and so at that point, I was a little overwhelming because I suddenly heard from, I don't know, something like 100 people, who many of whom I haven't heard from in years. But overall, a really fun and exciting chance to reconnect with people and tell them how they helped me along the way.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And let's talk about your research interests because that's why you won this award. And you researched some really interesting topics to me. Let's talk about binary stars to start off because they seem to be, if I was, going through all of your work, the one thing that kind of keeps popping up are binary star systems. Tell us about, let's just give us a little binary stars 101 for our audience about what they are, why they're important, and the different kinds there are, and why they interest you.
Right. So first of all, binary stars are very common. On Earth, we're kind of biased towards single stars because the star we know best is the sun, which is not a binary. But something like half of all stars in the universe are in binaries, and they come in many flavors, shapes, and sizes. But the real interesting thing about binaries for me, is they just make possible a much broader range of stellar evolution outcomes. So at this point, we've been studying how stars evolve for a few hundred years, and we have had a mathematical theory for about 100 years. So, with a few exceptions, if you have one star, and you know the initial conditions, you know its mass and what it's made out of, we can predict pretty well what it's going to do for the rest of its life. What kind of when it will expand and become a giant, what kind of remnant it will leave behind.
Yeah, like the sun, we know what the, what the sun's lifetime is going to be like. It's
That's right.
pretty simple compared to some of these other systems. But binaries, I'm starting to hear an echo of they're a little different.
Yeah, exactly. So stellar evolution, it's basically a 1D problem. Or at least you can do pretty well with a one-dimensional theory where the only dimension is like the radial coordinate from the inside to the outside of the star. And so we can solve the stellar structure equations and predict how stars will evolve using 1D differential equations. But interaction between two stars is inherently a three-dimensional problem. And it turns out even you only have a few free parameters that you can vary when you to change the properties of your binary, right? You can change how massive the two stars are, how far apart they are, and then what the shape of their orbit is. But it turns out if you vary those possibilities that you find in nature, you can get completely different outcomes. Right, you can have two binaries that start out looking pretty similar, but later in their evolution are unrecognizably different. So it's like a kind of a chaotic problem in that sense. And it's fun to work on because we see all kinds of binaries that look completely different, right? Some of them evolve on very short time scales. The shortest binaries we know of have orbital periods of just a few minutes. Others evolve on time scales of hundreds of millions of years. Some of them have outbursts in ultraviolet or X-rays where suddenly they get brighter by factors of 100 or 1,000. Some of them have stars that pulsate in ways that single stars don't. So you've got all this kinds of complicated phenomenology. But at the end of the day, we should be able to explain how all of that complexity arises using simple physics that's simple in the sense that we think we understand what all the relevant equations are. It just gets complicated once you put everything together.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Karim El-Badri. He's an astrophysicist at Caltech and a recent winner of a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. And thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Caltech astronomer Karim El-Badri. He's an astrophysicist who studies some of the most interesting objects in space, including hypervelocity stars, stars traveling so fast that they escape the massive gravity of their parent galaxies.
Basically, a hypervelocity star, the working definition is the star that's moving faster than the escape velocity of the Milky Way. So it's here now, but it's not going to stick around for long. And stars like that must have been accelerated through some exotic process because, you know, most of the stars, just for reference, most of the stars in the Milky Way are going around at something like 200 kilometers a second, which is already very fast. But the escape velocity is something like 600 kilometers a second from where the sun is. So they're all well under the escape velocity. And they have to be because if they were above the escape velocity, they would leave. And so in order for us to be able to observe them and for them to have been part of the galaxy, since the galaxy formed, they most of the stars have to be moving slower than the escape velocity. But then there are a few stars that are observed to go much faster than that, up to a few thousand kilometers a second. And that means that on cosmologically short times, they'll leave the Milky Way, fly through intergalactic space, occasionally enter another galaxy. So they're kind of the only intergalactic messengers between galaxies. And there are a few different ways you can launch them that people have come up with. So the first mechanism that became popular, as you said, I think in the 80s, but wasn't observationally confirmed until something like 20 years later, is you have a binary star, and it gets close to a supermassive black hole, like the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. And then you have this three-body interaction where one of the stars gets captured by the supermassive black hole, so it loses energy, and the other star gains energy and gets ejected at velocities that can be up to like 5,000 or 6,000 kilometers a second for the black hole in the center of the Milky Way. And those stars, we can observe, they go so fast that they basically don't even feel the gravitational potential of the galaxy, so they move almost in straight lines. And in the early 2000s, there was a survey to look for these hypervelocity stars that found something like 20 of them. The ones they found were all in the outer halo of the Milky Way, so they're already on their way out. They're already something like five times farther away from us than we are from the center of the Milky Way. And the community pretty quickly came to the agreement that those stars must have been launched by this mechanism from a supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. So this was before we had these 3D orbits of stars orbiting around the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. So at that point, there was some evidence that there's probably a black hole at the center of the Milky Way, but it wasn't totally solid yet. And so actually the discovery of these hypervelocity stars in the outer halo of the Milky Way was one of the pieces of evidence that there should be a supermassive black hole in the center. Anyway, so that's one mechanism for launching them. I'll just mention briefly the other mechanism that I've worked on recently. And so the other mechanism is if you have two stars in a close binary, and this works especially well if the stars are white dwarfs, because white dwarfs are very dense, and one of the stars explodes in a supernova, then the other star can get ejected at, again, velocities up to a few thousand kilometers a second. And we think both of these processes happen in nature because we see some stars that we think were launched by both of them. Probably the white dwarf mechanism, we have two white dwarfs in a binary and one of them explodes. That probably happens much more frequently than the supermassive black hole mechanism. But because white dwarfs are small and faint and hard to observe, it's harder to find the hypervelocity stars that are launched through that mechanism. And so of all the observed hypervelocity stars, probably more of those were launched by this supermassive black hole mechanism, even though the other mechanism is probably more common.
And when you talk about these exploding stars, these are type 1A supernovae, right?
That's right, or at least they're closely related to type 1A supernovae.
Could you explain, you know, for our listeners how that process works? Because that's really interesting how a star, two stars can lead to that explosive event.
Yeah, so first of all, I should maybe say what a white dwarf is. So when stars like the sun get to the end of their lives, they shed their outer layers and they leave behind this very compact, dense core that is usually made of carbon and oxygen. It's about the size of the Earth, but about the mass of the sun. So that means it's about a million times more dense than the sun is today. And most stars in the galaxy leave behind white dwarfs when they end their lives. And so a white dwarf can only be so massive. So white dwarfs are supported by something called electron degeneracy pressure. And it turns out if they get above a certain mass, which is close to 1.4 times the mass of the sun, they become unstable and they collapse. And so type 1a supernovae are what happen when a white dwarf explodes through some mechanism. You get a thermonuclear runaway in its core where the carbon fuses into heavier elements, and it's a runaway process. So within about a second, the whole white dwarf will explode and release a colossal amount of energy. And it's actually not totally understood what makes a white dwarf explode to make a type 1a supernova. Probably there's more than one process. So when I was first learning about astronomy, what it said in the textbook, it was that type 1a supernovae are what happen when a white dwarf gets to 1.4 solar masses, which is called the Chandrasekhar limit. It's the most massive white dwarf can be. And because of that, all type 1a supernovae should be basically the same, because they're all a white dwarf that's exactly 1.4 solar masses exploding. And since then, we've learned, and actually probably already back then, some people were suggesting, but the community has kind of recognized in the last decade or two, that probably it's more complicated. That mechanism might work in some cases, but it's definitely not the only thing that can make white dwarfs explode. The other thing I should just say about type 1a supernovae, which is the reason most people have heard about type 1a supernovae, is that they're all about equally bright. So they're not exactly equally bright, but if you observe a type 1a supernova, you can predict within something like a factor of 2 what its intrinsic luminosity is. So that makes them what people call standardizable candles.
Yeah, it's a standard candle. It gives you an idea. It would be like if I had two identical flashlights and I was holding one, and then I told my friend to go 600 yards further away and flash that other identical flashlight at you, you could figure out which one's farther away by its brightness.
Exactly. So if you observe a type 1a supernova, you can figure out how far away it is based on how bright it looks. And that makes type 1a supernova very useful for doing cosmology, because they're very bright. So even if they explode halfway across the universe, you can see them, and then you can measure their distance. And so they're very important in building the standard model of cosmology, and especially in discovering the acceleration of the universe through what astronomers now call dark energy. That discovery was made something like 25 or 30 years ago now, based on observations of type 1a supernovae in the distant universe.
And when getting back to our type 1a supernovae, explain again, how would that lead to kicking the star into hypervelocity?
Right. So the idea is you have two white dwarfs in a close binary. They start to merge, and only one of the white dwarfs fully explodes. So usually it's the white dwarf that's more dense that explodes. And it could be the other one doesn't explode at all, or it could be the other one loses some of its mass. It like partially explodes, but it's not completely destroyed. And so there'll be a piece of the lower mass white dwarf usually that survives. And that will then get ejected from the binary at its orbital velocity before the explosion, which, because white dwarfs are so dense, can be quite large, you know, up to about 3,000 kilometers a second. And it may also get some additional push from the supernova, right? The supernova is not totally symmetric, and so the remnant can recoil a bit if more ejecta goes in one direction than the other. And so after you have your type 1a supernova, you'll have a white dwarf or a piece of a white dwarf that's fleeing the scene at something like 3,000 kilometers a second, which is about 1% the speed of light. And it's about a factor of 10 faster than any of the other stars in the Milky Way around it. And so those white dwarfs we can observe. And if we're lucky, we can trace them back to the site of the supernova where they were launched.
I wonder what percentage of of type 1A supernovae would create hypervelocity stars. Do we have any kind of handle on that?
Yeah, that's one of the main reasons we're looking for these hypervelocity stars, is to understand what fraction of type 1A supernovae come from this double white dwarf channel versus other channels. Honestly, we don't have a very good answer yet. And the reason is we found a decent number of these hypervelocity stars. We have about 10 of them. But it turns out they're not, we don't really understand their stellar evolution. So I said they're white dwarfs, but they don't look exactly like white dwarfs anymore. They're inflated, so they're bigger and brighter than normal white dwarfs. And we think that's probably a result of the supernova that just happened next to them, that puffs them up, injects a lot of energy, and makes, and you know, also deposits heavy elements in their atmospheres. But because of that, it's hard to understand what fraction of the population we're seeing, because we don't know how long they stay as bright as they are. So when they're bright, it's easy to see them far away, and you'll find more of them. Once they contract and get fainter, you won't see as many of them. And so to understand how many of them are launched, you have to have a model for how bright they get and how their brightness evolves as a function of time to turn the observed population into inference about the true population. But with those caveats aside, the current thinking in the community, at least with me and my collaborators, is that probably most type 1A supernovae come from this kind of double white dwarf merger, but only a small fraction of double white dwarf mergers actually produce a hypervelocity star, because in many cases, the merger just explodes both white dwarfs. And so we only see cases where one of the white dwarfs or part of one of the white dwarfs survives.
That's fascinating. Okay, you mentioned at the top of the show the Gaia mission, the European Space Agency spacecraft. Could tell us about Gaia. Tell us what it does and why it's important for the type of work that you do.
Yeah, so Gaia is what got me started in this whole business. Gaia is a mission that does what's called astrometry. Not astronomy, but astrometry. Astrometry is basically the measurement of very small motions on the sky. So when we look at the sky, if we look today and tomorrow, for the most part, it looks like all the stars are in the same place. They're not moving measurably. That's the difference between planets and stars, is planets do move on human timescales, but stars don't. But it turns out if you can make measurements precisely enough, then actually everything is moving, because the stars are going around the orbits. They're going around the Milky Way in orbits, and their orbits are all a little bit different. And then the sun and the Earth are going around. The sun is moving up and down with respect to the galactic plane. And then in addition to that, I mentioned something like half of all stars are in binaries. And the ones that are in binaries are going around little orbits around their companions. And so if you can make precise enough measurements of the positions of stars, then you can detect all these motions. You can detect the binary companions. You can find stars that are moving unusually quickly. And you can also measure distances to stars. So that's one of the most important things about Gaia, is through a method called parallax, we can calculate how far away a star is. And the basic idea is, as Gaia and the Earth go around the sun, that's tracing out a circle whose radius we know. It's one astronomical unit. And that causes an apparent shift in the positions of all the stars, but the shift is larger for stars that are nearby than farther away. And so by measuring that, we can also calculate distances to stars, which before Gaia was one of the kind of fundamental uncertainties in astronomy, is except for a few special classes of objects like type 1A supernovae, it's very hard to measure distances. But Gaia has given us distances to stars in the Milky Way pretty much for free for hundreds of millions of stars. And so it opened up a lot of research areas that were much harder or impossible before.
And tell us exactly, like, how does Gaia work? Like, where is its orbit? Tell us a little bit about the spacecraft itself, as far as you know.
Yeah, so Gaia is at the L2 Lagrange point of the Earth-Sun system. So it's in an orbit going around the sun, but moving with the Earth, and it's a little bit farther away from the sun than the Earth is. It's something like a million miles from the Earth. It's put there because that's a good place to have stable orbits, so you don't have to burn a lot of fuel to stay in the same place. And, you know, it's always looking away from the sun so that it doesn't
blind itself.
It doesn't get too much bright light shining into its mirrors. And the spacecraft is rotating with a period of 6 hours. So as it rotates, the camera sweeps out a ring on the sky. And in that ring, it measures instantaneously where all the stars are. But then the rotation axis is precessing with a period of a few months. And so as it precesses, that ring sweeps out the whole sky. And the end result is that about once a month on average, Gaia returns to every point, every position on the sky, and measures where the stars are. And then the mission continues. It just does this over and over. And so Gaia collected about 11 years worth of measurements, roughly once a month, of where all the stars are. And so the end data product from Gaia is for something like 2 billion stars. We have very precise position measurements as a function of time, with something like 100 measurements per source.
And you've found some very cool things from that Gaia data. For example, let's talk about black holes a little bit because, you know, they're always interesting. I saw that you're referred to as the black hole killer. Tell us about that. What's that title all about?
Yeah. So in grad school, once I started working on the Gaia mission, one of the main things I wanted to do was look for black holes. And for the last 50 years or so, we've known about a small population of black holes in the Milky Way. There are about 20 of them. Those are what are called X-ray binaries, where you have a black hole that's eating a star, and they shine brightly in X-rays. But we expect that that's only a tiny fraction of the black hole population, because most black holes are not close enough to a star to eat the star and produce X-rays. So I wanted to find black holes that are farther, still orbited by stars, but are farther away. So the only evidence that there's a black hole would be the gravitational effects on the star that's orbiting it. And this was an active area of research at the time. There are lots of other groups looking for this as well. And it turns out it's a difficult problem because you're not actually seeing the black hole, right? You're not detecting any light from the black hole. All you're seeing is the gravitational effects. And so what you want to argue is you have a star that's orbiting something massive. That something massive is not producing any light, so it must be a black hole. But the reason it's tricky is maybe there's something massive that's only producing a little bit of light, and so it's very hard to see because the star is brighter. But it's kind of an evidence for black holes by the absence of seeing something else. And it turns out that whether you see something else is a function of how you look and how deeply you look. And so for the first 5 years or so of this hunt for non-accreting black holes in the community, there were many more false detections where people thought they found a black hole, but it turned out it was actually something else, like a faint star or a star that's rotating really rapidly, so it's harder to detect it spectroscopically. And so, you know, I was trying to do my own search for black holes, but whenever there was a discovery in the literature, I tried to look at the data and understand it myself. And one of the nice things about astronomy relative to a lot of other sciences is most of the data is public. So whenever there's a paper that somebody says, I found a black hole, you can just go download the data from a telescope archive somewhere, analyze it yourself, and see if you believe it. And there were something like 6 or 7 of these reported black holes in the span of a couple of years that ended up being unexpected types of mass transfer binaries that the people weren't thinking about before because we didn't know they existed or we didn't know they looked like this, rather than black holes. People would write a paper that says, I found a black hole, and then I would write a paper that says, well, actually, if you analyze the data in this other way or you get some other data, it looks like it's not a black hole, but it's a different kind of post-interaction binary. And so that's where my black hole killer title came from.
Well, black hole killer would be a really good thing for you to dress up as for Halloween. And I don't know how you'd do that, but you're a MacArthur fellow, so you'll figure it out. Well, another interesting thing that I saw was quiet black holes that Gaia has helped detect. Is that kind of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, that's right. So I did eventually also find some real black holes. At least I think they're real, and nobody has disproven them so far.
Nobody's killed them yet?
That's right. So I mentioned Gaia for hundreds of millions of stars is making these precise measurements of where they are. And for hundreds of thousands of those, the data is good enough that we can fit an orbit to the star's motion. So we first of all subtract the other source of motion, like the parallax from the sun's motion and the proper motion of the star as it moves through the galaxy. And there's still a wobble left. And so we can fit an elliptical orbit that follows Kepler's laws to that. And we can infer something about the mass and luminosity of the other star. And so there are a few of these systems we found where the inferred mass of the companion is much larger than the mass of the star you see. So we see a star that's like one solar mass, and it looks basically like the sun, but it's orbiting a companion that must be 10 solar masses. But then we take a spectrum, we look at how much light there is at all wavelengths, and at all wavelengths we only see light from this one solar mass star. And so the best explanation we can come up with is that there's a 10 solar mass black hole that it's orbiting. So it's a bit like those X-ray binaries we talked about, except that the star is farther away. And so by now, Gaia has found three black holes like this. In all cases, you have a star that's about one solar mass orbiting a black hole that's much more massive. And the separation is usually several astronomical units. And because of that, you don't see any light from accretion onto the black hole. The black hole is far enough away from the star that basically no matter is getting into it and it's not producing any light, but we can infer it's there from the orbit.
Yeah, and an astronomical unit is just the distance between the Earth and the Sun.
That's right.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with newly minted MacArthur Fellowship winner Karim El-Badri. The Caltech astronomer uses massive amounts of observational data and computer modeling to investigate some of the most interesting objects in the universe: binary star systems, black holes, neutron stars, and hypervelocity stars. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Caltech astrophysicist Karim El-Badri. He recently won a MacArthur Fellowship for his work on some of the most interesting objects in deep space, like binary star systems, black holes, and hypervelocity stars. You were involved in a really interesting study about a possible supermassive black hole in a place that no one had thought of there being one before. We always kind of recently have thought that, okay, yes, we know there are these supermassive black holes like Sagittarius A star, the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and we think that they're basically in the center of most huge galaxies. But you guys have inferred that there may be one in a little tiny mini galaxy that's not very far away. Tell us about the Large Magellanic Cloud. Where is that, and why is it important?
Yeah, so the Large Magellanic Cloud is kind of the closest galaxy to the Milky Way that's not the Milky Way. It's about, it's something like six times farther away from the Milky Way than the Sun is from the center of the Milky Way. So it's close enough that it's interacting gravitationally with the Milky Way, but it's far enough away that it hasn't started to merge with it. It's clearly still its own galaxy. And people have known about the Large Magellanic Cloud for hundreds of years, probably thousands of years, because if you go to the southern hemisphere, you can see it even with the naked eye. And in terms of its stellar mass, it's something like 100 times less massive than the Milky Way, or maybe a few hundred times
less massive. Yeah, it's a pretty puny galaxy.
That's right. And so it goes back to the hypervelocity stars. I mentioned in the early 2000s, a sample of about 20 of these hypervelocity stars were found in the outer halo of the Milky Way. And pretty quickly, most of the community agreed that these were launched by this mechanism where you get a binary that goes close to a supermassive black hole, and it flings one of the stars away at high velocity. But at the time, we could really only measure line of sight velocities to these stars. So they're so far away that they should also be wobbling or moving on the plane of the sky because their motion is 3D. So some component of that motion should be projected onto the plane of sky. But that was too small to measure. We could only measure the radial velocity, which you can measure from spectroscopy. It's easier to measure. And so that was the case for 20 years or so. But just in the last few years, now that we have Gaia, people have been able to measure and use the other two components of these stars' velocities, that is their motion on the plane of the sky. And now we have three components of the velocity, two measured by Gaia and one from spectroscopy. And we also know roughly how far away these stars are. And so we can try to trace their orbits back to see where they came from and test the hypothesis of did they actually come from the center of the Milky Way or not. And so we did this in the last couple of years. This work was led by one of my collaborators, Jesse Hahn, who's now a postdoc at Stanford. And what Jesse found is that some of these stars definitely do trace back to the center of the Milky Way, but some of them definitely don't. And it's actually about 50-50, where about half of these stars, if we take the cone of past possible trajectories that's set by the uncertainties and the motions we measure today, about half of them don't get anywhere near the center of the Milky Way. And so it's very, unless the measurements were totally wrong, you can't come up with a picture where these are coming from the center of the Milky Way. And so then we said, well, what if we just keep tracing them back even further? Where do they go? And if you just leave the Milky Way where it is today and the Large Magellanic Cloud where it is today, and you trace them back, they don't really seem to go anywhere. But of course, the Milky Way and the Large Magellanic Cloud are also moving with respect to each other. And so if you do a full dynamical model where you trace the stars back along their current trajectories, and you also rewind the orbits of the Milky Way and the Large Magellanic Cloud, you find that something like 100 million years ago, most of these stars that don't go back to the center of the Milky Way, their orbits intersect with where the Large Magellanic Cloud was 100 million years ago. And so their orbits are consistent with having been launched from the Large Magellanic Cloud rather than from the Milky Way. And because the best mechanism we know of to launch normal stars that are not white dwarfs at these high velocities involves a supermassive black hole, the only explanation we could come up with, or at least the best explanation, is that there's also a supermassive black hole in the Large Magellanic Cloud, and that it's responsible for launching these hypervelocity stars.
That's just fascinating. It's like everything in astrophysics and nature in general is just every time you look around a new corner, you find new surprises. And that's one of the wonderful things about the kind of research you do.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So a lot of the research I've done in the last, 5 years or so is motivated by these large sky surveys. And it's a little bit different of a mode of doing astronomy than was common a few decades ago.
Yeah, it's not like you're peering through a telescope and gathering images and spectroscopic measurements and stuff like that. You're literally using gigantic data sets.
That's right. And I mean, at the end of the day, these gigantic data sets do come from telescopes, but they're dedicated telescopes that rather than looking at that one source individually that one astronomer wants to look at, they just spend most of their time tiling the sky, making measurements of brightnesses or colors or motions of billions of stars at once. And the community has realized that that's in the long term, that's a valuable investment of telescope time, because even though, most of the stars you look at aren't doing anything, when you tile the whole sky, you find all kinds of things that you didn't know you should have been looking for in the first place. And every time you do a new survey at a new wavelength or on a new time scale, you find new objects that you didn't even know you should have been looking for before.
It's fascinating to me to think about you and your career, and you're in the prime of your career, the incredible instrumentation that's at your disposal for the community of astronomers around the world. You know, you've got the James Webb Space Telescope now, all of these big survey instruments doing the kind of work you're talking about. It really is golden age in astronomy, isn't it?
It really is. And it's funny you should call it the golden age, because astronomers in their proposals for at least the last 50 years have always been writing, we are in the golden age of astronomy, or we're in a renaissance of some area. Mm-hmm. And basically, as long as things keep getting better, we can always be in the golden age. And there's no sign of it turning over anytime soon. And so, yeah, you mentioned the James Webb Space Telescope, which launched a few years ago now. Incidentally, yesterday was the deadline for proposals for the next cycle of James Webb Space Telescope proposals. So at Caltech and at astronomy institutes all over the country, yesterday everybody was scrambling to finish their proposals to try to get some time to look at the next thing.
Are you one of those?
Oh, yeah. I was on like 15 of these proposals. It turns out, you know, it's such a great telescope that there are far more things you'd want to do with it than
there's time to do.
Yeah. So it's at this point, it's something like 10% of all the time that people would like to spend actually is available. So on average, something like 10% of proposals get accepted. But you can you might be able to increase your odds by writing more proposals as long as some of them have good ideas.
I'm also wondering how, you know, new computing tools and AI, you know, I could see where, you know, AI can be kind of creepy for us in a lot of ways for people like me. But for somebody like you working with all of this data, I would imagine that there's a lot of cool tools at your disposal that make your work a little less tedious.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of new data analysis algorithms and tools that we've been playing with in the last few years. And I think we still don't really know where AI is going as far as data analysis is concerned. So one of the things we often want to do with these large data sets is find anomalies. And usually if you search for anomalies in the most obvious ways, you just find bad data. You know, even if you have a great data set, there are always going to be some artifacts. And so if you sort your data set by, you know, the brightest or the fastest or the closest, the top of the list is almost always bad data. And when you're looking for an intrinsically rare population, like these black holes orbited by stars, for example, it turns out only about 1 in 10 million stars, we think, is orbiting a black hole at the separations where Gaia can detect it. And so whatever search method you have needs to have a very low false positive rate in order to find candidates without being totally swamped by false positives. And so we've been experimenting with lots of different machine learning techniques to try to filter through the junk data and find the most promising candidates. So far, it's hard to beat traditional data analysis methods, actually, in the sense that, you know, when we're fitting orbits, we have a physical model that describes exactly what the motion should be, right? We have Kepler's laws. And so AI will never give a more accurate description than Kepler's laws of what the actual sources we're looking for should be doing. But it seems to be better than other methods we've tried of just filtering out the junk and finding the objects that are not black holes.
Final thoughts on what do you most enjoy about your work and being at a place like Caltech, briefly?
Caltech is a great place to do astronomy, both because we have access to great telescopes and great data sets. So that's great. But I think even more important, we have access to collaborators that make all of this kind of research possible.
It's a team effort.
That's right. And so this Gaia mission, for example, so I'm part of the collaboration now that makes a Gaia data set. And that collaboration has hundreds of people in it. And then in my research group here, we have, you know, something like 10 people between graduate students and undergraduates and postdocs. And basically all of these discoveries involve lots of back and forth between different people and exchange of ideas. And most of the ideas that we get, you know, are not the result of somebody just sitting around thinking, but they're the result of going to a talk and you know, somebody asks an interesting question that makes you think of something a little bit differently, and then you talk about it more with other people. And then if it turns out the idea was not a good one, you also often find that out when you run it by somebody else. I think that's the most exciting thing about the community I can work with for me. Just in terms of doing astronomy, I really like that, you know, there's so much about the universe that we don't understand yet. But every day we have a chance to find out something new, and we have a much more freedom, or I don't know about more, but we have a lot of freedom, more than I could have imagined I would have had every day to decide what are we going to think about today? What new problem are we going to try to tackle? And I really appreciate that freedom.
Well, Karim El-Badri, astronomer from Caltech and newly minted MacArthur Fellow, congratulations again, and thanks for joining us. It was lovely talking to you.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to talk to you.
Thanks again to our guest, Caltech Assistant Professor of Astronomy and new recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, Karim El-Badri. You can learn more about him and the other MacArthur Fellows at macfound.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.